KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Paleontologist Neil Shubin joins us to talk about our evolutionary human origins, which are beyond the anthropocentric, as he takes us back billions of years when we not only slept with the fishes, if you recall The Godfather, but were the fishes. Forum is next as we talk to the author of Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3 to 5 billion year History of the Human Body. Coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Neil Shubin is provost of the Field Museum and professor of anatomy at the University of Chicago, where he is also an associate dean. An evolutionary biologist, he was the leading paleontologist who discovered fossils north of the Arctic Circle that made headlines in April 2006, the discovery of a 375-million-year-old amphibious creature believed to be the missing link between sea creatures and land dwellers. Neil Shubin's book is called Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3 to 5 billion year History of the Human Body, and he joins us for this forum hour. Good to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome back. You got some Berkeley roots, right?
Yes, I do. Deep.
Well, let's start off. There's so much in this book to talk about. I found a great pleasure in reading it, and so did Tina Lauerberg, our production assistant. Let's go back to your discovery, though, first, because this was major. I mean, it's been compared to Lucy and... First of all, help me with the Inuit pronunciation.
Tiktaalik.
Tiktaalik. Okay, I thought so, but I didn't want to go on the... This is up in the Arctic wilderness, and this was, a species that told us a lot. You were looking for something from this mid-Devonian era, and you found it.
Yeah, I mean, we started the whole project in 1998 with a prediction based on evolutionary theory. That is, at rocks about 375 million years ago, we should find a wonderful intermediate between life in water and life on land. So we began this thing, actually our first trip in 1999, and made about 4 trips over 6 years before we found Tiktaalik. It was a real struggle. We weren't successful at first. We really had to stick with it, and actually our funders had to stick with it as well. But in 2004, we discovered this creature, and it was a remarkable moment for all of us.
It kind of... gave credence to a lot of the work that you'd been doing, really, didn't it?
Yeah, it was for us, it was just exciting to have this creature. If I was to hold Tiktaalik in front of you, it's an animal that varies in size between 4 feet and 9 feet long. And you'd look at it at first and you'd see, scales on its back and fin webbing, and it would look like a fish. But then it would look a lot like an early amphibian. Like an early amphibian, it would have a flat head with eyes on top. It would have a neck where the head can move independently of the body. No fish has a neck. And then when you look inside the fin, what do you see? Bones that correspond to our upper arm, forearms, even parts of our wrist and palm. I mean, remarkable intermediate between life in water and life on land.
Maybe the first creature with a neck, huh?
It's absolutely the first one in the fossil record with a neck like ours. And it was just a remarkable moment for us to see this thing. And it revealed itself in the laboratory over about 6 months during... the fall of 2004.
And the word in Inuit means large freshwater fish.
Exactly. Yeah. We wanted the name, when we knew the thing was going to be important, we wanted a name to reflect its provenance from the Nunavut territory and the Inuit people who let us work there.
Speaking about important names and evolution, your own evolution goes back to Sir Richard Owen did a book in 1859, but this is the notion that we're all of a kind of similar architecture, that you look to the embryos, and you have done this in your research, and you find where the evolutionary architecture is.
Exactly. When you look at fossils, when you look at embryos, when you look at anatomy, what you see is all animals are variations on a theme, a very deep and beautiful theme that has its roots in history, and that there's no way you can understand the diversity of life without knowing something about that long history.
So that old popular song is right. Everybody's beautiful in the same way.
Exactly.
Everything's beautiful, yeah. This is extraordinary, though. I mean, as you begin to get into your work and find out what it's all about, that our body is actually organized like a fish. I mean, this is difficult for people to grasp.
Oh, I know. I was really revealed this dramatically when I was teaching human anatomy at the University of Chicago. And I'd be, there's a really important course for the first year medical students, and they'd come to me and they'd say, Dr. Shubin, what kind of doctor are you? And they're thinking, are you a thoracic surgeon, a gastroenterologist? And I said, well, I'm a fish paleontologist. And it was remarkable because in teaching the human head and opening the human head, you'd see how just wonderfully complicated it is. But then you can simplify it by showing the state of affairs in sharks and fish. You can show how our limbs are designed like the fins of fish, and indeed much of the neural wiring and the muscular patterns are much like a fish. That is, our body plan, from our heads to our appendages to our to the whole way we're put together, has deep roots, and fish are a wonderful window into that those roots.
Well, you got a good deal of humor, I guess, when you appeared on Stephen Colbert's show, because he was talking about fish teeth becoming human breasts, made a good deal out of that.
Yeah, he did.
But you were actually talking there about the ears being the tree of life from jellyfish to fish, and about noses and knees and hiccups, all of these things really tying us all together to other species.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Ears are a wonderful microcosm of the evolutionary tree of life that's embedded in our own bodies. I mean, we carry 3.5 billion years of history, more than that actually, more than 3.5 billion years of history in every cell, in every organ, and in every gene in our bodies. And the ear is a wonderful window because, you know, you look at the outer flap, that's our part of our mammalian past. We have three little bones in the middle of our ear. Two of those are part of the past we share with reptiles. One of those is part of the past we share with fish. And then when you look at the inner ear, that's part of the past we share with jawless fish, and indeed the DNA recipe that builds it goes back to our relatives that we share with jellyfish and beyond.
So our arms were fins.
Oh, absolutely.
Talking to Neil Shubin, his book is Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3 to 5 Billion Year History of the Human Body. And as he said, he's a guy who teaches anatomy, among other things, does paleontological research and goes out on those digs and found something that caused a great deal of sensation a few years ago up in the Arctic. There's a book by Colin Roberts that we talked about on the air. I don't know if you know it, about the oceans. And he claims fish today have personalities. This guy who's done a lot of work in the oceans and oceanography and everything.
Well, I'm a fisherman. I know that by just by trying to catch him sometimes.
Yeah, but I mean, he claims that, you know, the personality is almost in a human way, and I don't know. We're learning so much from the Genome Project, and we're learning so much about you know, how related we are to, well, even worms and bacteria and all that. But when you get into things like personality and consciousness, you get into some pretty murky areas.
Well, it's tough. I mean, the comparisons get very difficult. You know, what's the unit to compare? And it gets harder and harder as you try to compare behaviors and functions. It actually makes anatomy look very easy.
That's right. But I learned from you, for example, that this is kind of a scary thought. Whales had legs.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
They're ancestors,
I mean,
sure.
Of course, they're mammals, but so are bats, and bats had hands.
Oh, absolutely. They still do. They're just a modified hand that they fly with.
So all of these things, again, suggest the kind of consanguinity. There's a word that I hesitate to use, but, you know, common blood or something like that.
Well, you know, what you see when you're an anatomist or an embryologist or a geneticist is you see the deep connections between all life on this planet. And you can see those connections written in the structures of skeletons of animals. You can see it written in the way those animals develop. And even, and most importantly, in terms of the research that's being done today, is you could see it written in the DNA recipe that builds bodies. And those are where some of the most profound similarities lie.
And a human's hand and a fly's wing.
Yeah, and it's really remarkable. This is a stunner that colleagues and I, Cliff Tabin and Sean Carr and I, were thinking about in the late 90s, is that much of the genetic recipe that builds a human hand is actually shared with things as far removed from us as fly wings. It seems there are real deep commonalities to the toolkits that build human bodies, fish bodies, worm bodies, and so forth. And that's just a wonderfully powerful thing if you're a scientist, because it opens up all kinds of new questions for you to explore. We can begin to ask the wonderful question, what makes the DNA recipe of a fly different from the DNA recipe that builds the body of a human? You know, these are questions
we're asking that question.
We're asking those questions now, and we're going to likely have answers to them in the coming decade. It's just it's a good time to be a scientist.
So we know our hands, for example, we're talking about the hand again, resembled fish fins.
Absolutely. And look at the fin of Tiktaalik. I mean, the fin of Tiktaalik has fin webbing, right? And if you remove that fin webbing, you start to find bones that look like our upper arm bone, the humerus, the two forearm bones, the radius and ulna, even bones that correspond to parts of the wrist and palm. Those compare directly. That's Owen back in the 1800s recognized that evolutionary plan. Not evolutionary, that anatomical plan.
He was more prescient in some ways than Darwin, really, wasn't he?
Well, yeah. Well, he was a wonderful anatomist and a very careful anatomist. Much of what we do in anatomy is actually derived from some of Darwin's insights and Owen's insights before him.
And what do the hiccups have to do with this?
Well, hiccups actually, you know, when you do a hic and you go, that sort of thing, that actually what you're doing is you're closing your glottis and you're doing a sharp inspiration. The way that's generated is in the brainstem, there's what's known as a central pattern generator. Because what you have is to do that hic, you have a stereotypical pattern of firing of muscles. And that's controlled by a rhythmic pattern of neural activity in the brainstem. It's written deeply in the brainstem.
It's in the neurotransmitters, basically.
Oh, yeah, and it's actually in the way that these, it's the connectivity between the neural
tracts. Yeah.
And so then when you go and look to the animal world and see where you see that, it's actually seen in creatures that breathe with both gills and lungs, where they actually close the glottis and then take a sharp inspiration. And you see it in larval creatures like tadpoles. Indeed, the neurological signature of a hiccup is virtually in our brainstem is virtually identical to that which is seen in breathing tadpoles.
Neil Shubin with us is the author of Your Inner Fish, yours as well as mine. It's a journey into the 3 to 5 billion year history of the human body. As we learn more about this anatomy, this evolutionary sense of our anatomy, we learn more, and with the Genome Project too, we learn more about diseases. And you talk, for example, about the links that go back that tell us more about diseases, and that and we're talking about human as well as animal diseases. We understand more about medicine. We understand more about veterinary as well as human medicine.
Yeah, one thing, you know, when you look at the human body as an anatomist, and you know, in the human lab, but we were dissecting cadavers actually. You know, what you see is we're not designed very intelligently. We're designed historically. That is, when you look inside the human head and you look at the nerves in there, if you look in the human pelvis and you look at the courses that vessels take, what you find is bizarre detours and loops and turns and twists that make no sense. I mean, nobody in their right mind would have designed a body like this. It reminds me of the time when they did.
You mean that. God was not in his right mind?
Right. I mean, fish were in the right mind, though. And the thing is, you can straighten out these loops and turns and detours when you look at our history. And a great example is the spermatic cord in males, human males. You know, males are susceptible to a particular type of hernia. We have a weak body wall, and the reason why we have that weakness is the spermatic cord takes a weird loop as it goes over the pelvis from the testes and the scrotum to the penis. And our testes actually are descended. What happens is when development, the testes begin up towards the chest where the kidneys are and then descend as we develop.
Didn't you write about in sharks the testes are up in the, like, the head region?
Or? Exactly. And as we begin development, testes, we as an embryo, have a pattern much like that of a shark, where the testes are up towards the chest area. Only we gain our mammalness as development proceeds, and the testes descend to form a scrotum. The problem is that's a really bad design, because as the testes descend to do that weird loop-a-loop, human males have a very weak abdominal wall, and we're susceptible to a particular kind of hernia because of that.
Well, that's the trade-off for our fish ancestry again, isn't it?
Exactly.
And, we got worms and reptiles as our ancestors, too. Why exalt the fish here?
Well, you know, I exalt the fish because I look at them every day. That's what I work on. The fish actually is wonderfully informative for understanding the basic structure of our skeleton. But if you want to understand the DNA recipe that builds us, fish are just really kind of one stop in this chain. Worms are particularly useful. Flies are particularly useful. Indeed, it looks like relatives of living jellyfish, like sea anemones, are particularly useful.
And let's not forget, I remember my Linnaeus Porifera, right?
Oh, absolutely.
The sponges.
Absolutely. You see antecedents of the genetic recipe, even the genes that build us, even far back as that. But fish actually are wonderfully informative. I mean, if I showed you the body plan of a fish and how it develops, that's a dramatic roadmap to understanding the structure of our heads, our backs, our teeth, major portions of our anatomy. But if I want to understand things in more detail, like the evolution of my ear bones, or actually the evolution of how we chew and things like that, then creatures we call reptiles become very important, because it's almost impossible to understand the structure of our middle ear without understanding the transition from reptile to mammal, an event that happened over 200 million years ago.
So if I call somebody reptilian, it's not necessarily an insult, then.
They're only hearing you because of their reptile past.
Right. Actually, I was just reading that D.H. Lawrence said to Catherine Mansfield, "You are a loathsome reptile, and you deserve to die." Believe it or not, I'm a very friendly thing from a fellow Bloomsburyite. But what does this all mean about the future of evolution as you see it?
Well, you know, we are a product of our past. And so, you know, anything we do in the future is affected by this 3.5 billion year history. It means a lot of things, and there's many ways to take an answer to that question. One of them is, you know, when we look at our connections to the rest of life, it provides us wonderful opportunities to understand and to attack basic diseases. I mean, look at the Nobel Prizes in medicine or physiology over the last 13 years. Actually, just look at them over the last 6 years. Two of those Nobel Prizes have gone to five people working on a little tiny worm the size of a comma that lives in dirt. And that little worm has provided absolutely major insights to understanding how our genes work. And if we are going to find cures to some of the major ills that suffer us, from cancers to other things, the technologies developed and understandings developed from that little tiny worm, which just has a handful of cells, more or less, are going to have a major impact for human health. I can imagine no better statement about why the connectivity between all life on this planet, among all life on this planet, is important than a statement like that.
Well, back to fish for the moment, since the fish bones, I think you intimated this before, are the basic structure of the human body.
Very much. In fact, many of the bones and muscles and nerves that I'm using to talk to you with right now, and the structures that you're using to hear me with, actually relate to gill bones and correspond to gill bones in fish and sharks. You know,
so when Stephen Colbert says, "Where are gills?" Right, that's your answer.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Was Darwin wrong then?
Yeah, he's a human being. He's wrong about a lot of things. Wrong about what in particular?
Well, about just the kind of assumptions we're aware of now with respect to evolution that you're making.
Well, you know, one of the remarkable things about Darwin, though, is, you know, he came up with the notion of evolution by natural selection, common descent, before there was a theory of genetics. You know, before there was any understanding of DNA, before we really knew much about how embryos build bodies, and they had some of the glimmers of it at that time. Yet the insights he provided, you know, over 100 years ago, allow us to make predictions about DNA, about things he didn't even know about. I mean, to me, that's a sign of a very successful scientific theory, in that we're still using his framework to make predictions. We used it to find Tiktaalik, you know, back starting in 1998. Other people are using it when they assess the genome, which relates to another big aspect here, which is the story of evolution is not just the story of fossils or embryos or DNA or anatomy. It's all of it. It's all those lines of together, all those lines of evidence. That
synchronicity
together,
of all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, they work together. It's a remarkable thing.
And yet we tend to think fossil.
Yeah,
for proof and empirical proof particularly.
We do, but in fact, if you look at the way the field's moving, fossils are just one small line of evidence. Actually, the DNA evidence is wonderfully powerful.
And tell us a little bit about where your research is going.
Yeah, we're doing a couple things right now. If you walked into my laboratory at University of Chicago, what you'd see is a molecular lab. We do a lot of DNA work on fins and limbs. Again, getting at this idea of how do we compare the DNA recipe that builds a fin to that of a limb. But we also do fossil work, and so this summer, actually, when I get back to Chicago, we have to plan next summer's expedition to the Canadian Arctic. It takes a lot of preparation to get there. We have a site that's still producing Tiktaaliks, so we're finding more specimens. We have about 11 of them now.
Getting a little more funding, too, since you made that big discovery, I'll bet, aren't you?
Yeah, a bit more. It's a little bit more stable. We want to go to upper, younger, and older rocks. There's a whole places in the Arctic we haven't even explored yet. And, you know, so we want to break up our team and we want to find...
You were actually north of the Arctic Circle, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. We were at a latitude of 80 north. It's daylight 24 hours a day. There are polar bears running around. It's a really exotic place.
I'm talking a lot about skeletal structure here. What about the viscera?
Yeah, the viscera are remarkable. The guts that we have, in fact, all the membranes that support our guts are actually seen in very basic form in a shark. And, in fact, the subdivisions of the gut that we use to digest our food and so forth actually traced to the transition from sort of a headless worm to a creature with a backbone. It seems at that stage that the original sort of design of guts came into being very gradually, probably using genes that were already around in worms and so forth.
Do you have a position on the birds and dinosaurs?
I think the evidence is unequivocally in support of a bird relationship to dinosaurs, absolutely. I mean, it's fossils, it's anatomy and so forth.
And DNA?
Well, DNA, it's a little tougher in that particular.
That's what I would have guessed. Talking to Neil Shubin, his book is called Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3 to 5 billion year History of the Human Body, and talking about how we're all related, all, you know, the philosophical questions that really are related to our all being related just continue to sort of pop off in my mind. I mean, I know this isn't necessarily your area, but it does certainly raise all kinds of questions along those lines. What have been some that you've encountered?
Well, I mean, to me, there's just a wonderful aesthetic to the whole thing. That our humanity, what we, you know, that which we cherish, that which makes us so unique, which is absolutely unique and wonderful and powerful, is really built by bits and pieces shared with everything from things that we call worms, jellyfish, sponges, and so forth.
Cosmic dust, too. I mean, stellar, interstellar space and all that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The utterly unique and beautiful could be made from something very common. I mean, I find that aesthetically beautiful.
The blueprint design itself, we share with sharks.
Absolutely.
And you don't have to be a lawyer, right?
You don't. And in fact, the recipe that builds it, we share with worms and so forth. So we can see this history unfolding over 3.5 billion years. And the beautiful thing about being a paleontologist or a biologist now is that we can actually use many different tools to begin to take that, dissect it and take it apart and make predictions and go test them.
Of course, in your subtitle, you say 3 to 5 billion year history. Mm-hmm. I mean,
3.5, yeah.
But we don't have necessarily. How do we track that? How do we actually? You're talking about carbon dating and those kinds of things.
Well, yeah, there are a variety of techniques to actually carbon dating. By that point, doesn't work. It's more other techniques: uranium, lead, argon, and other things. You know, and that's one of the things. Actually, when getting back to the Tiktaalik discovery, we were caught unawares with Tiktaalik when we found it. We didn't have the geology worked out very well. So one of the things, actually, we need to work on the dating of those rocks and the geology of those rocks better, because the Tiktaalik discovery sort of caught us by surprise.
You're working with geologists, though.
Oh, yeah, now it is, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking with Neil Shubin. His book is Your Inner Fish, Journey into the 3.5 billion year History of the Human Body. I'm going to open the phone lines and invite those of you who are listening to join us. You are welcome to be a part of the discussion on this program. You may want to talk about, well, all the evolutionary and anatomical things we've been talking about, or you may have a question for Professor Shubin. You may want to ask him about his discovery, the discovery of this amphibious creature that's believed to be the missing link between sea creatures and land dwellers. Again, the book is called Your Inner Fish, and your calls are welcome, and you can join us now toll-free, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our number is 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free number for your calls, 866-733-6786, or send us an email. We welcome your emails as well, and our email address here is simply forum@kqed.org. What kind of response are you getting to your book, Neil?
Enthusiastic, and the one that really means most to me is I gave a talk the other night, and there were in the first two rows a bunch of high schoolers sitting in the audience, and that to me is wonderful, because that's the future.
Well, your enthusiasm is infectious, and you write well, and the combination is irresistible. So we'll find out what our listeners have to say and what they want to contribute. Again, we're talking to Neil Shubin. His book is Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 Billion Year History of the Human Body. And we're coming up on a break here. You tell us about this. This is the creature on the cover.
Yeah, Tiktaalik's on the cover.
But kind of, well, morphed into looking like it looked like, or morphed backwards, I guess. We'll take your calls and emails when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Neil Shubin, the author of Your Inner Fish. He'll be at Kepler's in Berkeley this evening at 7:30, and he's with us here for the rest of the hour. So let's go to your calls and find out what's on your mind in this whole realm that we're talking about here. Richard, you're first up. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm extremely excited to hear about this new book. I'm going to be the first in line to pick it up tonight at Kepler's. Congratulations. Great stuff.
Thank you.
It seems like it's also a bit of a continuation of Richard Dawkins' book, The Ancestor's Tale, and basically you're just proving it. But my question is, how do you advise your listeners that do believe in evolution to communicate what you've learned and what others have learned to family and friends that may be less inclined to believe in evolution and what you're learning and what you found?
That's a wonderful question, because I actually experienced that myself. And you know,
you're not an advisor to Mike Huckabee, are you?
No, but I'm an advisor to some of my family. And they sometimes, some of my family has issues with evolution, believe it or not. I think the answer here is really what I try to do is to convey the sense that evolution is a wonderful and important, indeed the best platform we have for scientific discovery. That is to make predictions that we can test. That is, in finding Tiktaalik, we made a prediction based on evolutionary theory, which we were able to test. In the work we do with DNA, and everybody else in the country does with DNA, we're making predictions that are tested. And that science is not about as much about what is known. It's about what is unknown. And that if we knew everything, we wouldn't need scientists or science. And that what we look for in our scientific theories are very powerful explanatory frameworks, which are incredibly well supported by the data. And evolution meets all of those. And, what I like to tell people is that the unknown should not be a source where, a problem that I can't solve shouldn't be a source where I have to retreat to superstition. That for me, it's a challenge to really sort of solve the puzzle, work the problem, and use the tools we have.
What about the argument, I'm sure you've heard this, that maybe with your work up in the Arctic Circle, you were fitting the facts to support the hypothesis? Or, what if you were searching for something else up there, for example?
Yeah, well, we were, basically when you go to a place, you're actually looking for everything. I mean, we were there looking for a Tiktaalik-like creature, but we were actually scanning the rocks to find anything in there. So if there was, some sort of bizarre creature, we would have found it. In fact, there's a wonderful story, because we could have tested the entire evolutionary theory with our work in the Arctic. It's a falsifiable and scientific framework. What if lying next to Tiktaalik, I found a human skull embedded in those same rocks? That would have showed us which much of what we know about the fossil record, indeed evolution, is wrong. And it would have sent scientists scrambling for back to the drawing board. And that's what science is about. And the other, to relate your question to the callers, actually is that the powerful thing about evolution is it's not just one line of evidence that supports it. It's fossils, it's DNA, it's cells, it's embryos. And it's all those different lines of evidence together that tell us what's happening. And each one alone is beautiful. But together, it's just sublime.
Well, the caller also mentioned Richard Dawkins, and there been some heavy debates on this program years ago between, never together, but Richard Dawkins and the late Stephen Jay Gould, and wondered where you come down on all that.
Well, Dawkins was a real proponent of individual selection being a very powerful force in shaping organisms. Gould took a wider view, which basically said that, selection can work at many levels. And I think, to some extent, Gould was right. We do know that anything that can vary in a heritable way and can produce differential, survivability or fitness, we call it, can evolve by natural selection, whether it's at the level of species, genes, or individuals. So I think I take a much broader view, more along the Gould school of thought. But one thing that Gould would tend to overlook is just the simple sheer power that natural selection acting in individuals and at the level of genes has in sculpting bodies. And so to some extent, I'm a Gouldian, but I recognize the strong power of natural selection.
And we recognize the power of our listeners. Wanda, good morning.
Good morning. I would like him to speak about dolphins and whales and the relationship between them and fish and the evolution. I saw a whale skeleton in the Bishop Museum in Hawaii and was struck at the similarities between humans and whales in the hand or the flipper and other things. But would you speak about whales and dolphins?
Yeah, great question. Fish evolved to walk on land. Tiktaalik and its descendants gave rise to things we commonly call reptiles. But also those gave rise to things we call mammals. And mammals are land-living creatures. At some point in the distant past,
not whales.
Exactly. And mammals evolved. One group of mammals, four-legged mammals that lived on land, returned to the water. And, we call them whales, but there are other creatures that did this as well. What's interesting here is, when mammals returned to the oceans, or at least one lineage of mammals returned to the ocean, they didn't do it as fish. They did it as mammals, as your question reveals. That is, if you open up the arm bone of a whale, right, and you compare it to the arm bone of a fish, what you find is that's a mammal arm that became modified into a flipper, okay? Not a series of fish bones that is functioning as a flipper. When whales enter the oceans, they did so as mammals, and you can see it written across their skeleton, and you see it written in their DNA as well. And that's a wonderful power. It shows the power of understanding history in seeing how organisms adapt to new environments.
And we thank you, Wanda. We go to Everett, Washington. Dee, you're on. Hi.
Hi, Professor. I read a little bit about blood, and then I discovered that we all human had a different blood type. And the first question is that how does this blood in human was formed, throughout all these little bits and pieces around us? And the second question is that from studying about this blood, I learned that all human beings starts from Africa and then spreads around the world. So how this Africa, which is a very dry area, related to this fish? Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that question. By the way, I misspoke. I said Kepler's in Berkeley. They're in Menlo Park. And Neil will be there tonight at 7:30, just for the record. I don't think there is a Kepler's in Berkeley. Professor Schumann used to live in Berkeley, so my wires got crossed. But I need to evolve more, obviously. Go ahead, Neil.
Thanks. Well, blood is very ancient. And what we talk about blood, really, is a collection of several different kinds of cells. And a fluid medium which has various molecules in it which enables it to function. So blood's a wonderfully complicated thing, batches of cells in a soup of molecules. And we can look at the evolutionary history of different parts of that thing we call blood, and it actually has very, very deep roots. We can trace the evolutionary history of the red blood cells and trace them all the way down to ancient fish, to jawless fish, and so forth. And we can then even look at the molecules that do the gas exchange that actually, the oxygen exchange within the hemoglobin, within the red blood cells themselves. And they, too, have an evolutionary history and a tree of life embedded in them. So the example of blood is really wonderful because you can look at the entity blood, and then you can decompose that entity into its constituent cells and molecules and so forth, and you can see a tree of life embedded in each of those that itself goes back to fish.
And I thank the caller, and we go to Iowa. Ryan, hi.
Hi. This might seem like a really elementary question, but in all my biology and science classes and everything, I always heard that we all came from one descendant line. But with the time scale of Earth and the size, scope of Earth, isn't it possible that in different areas of the Earth, whether it be land or water, life forms were developing, and there could be several lines on Earth that come from, different origination species?
Yeah, that's a great question, because what it gets to is sort of one of the things working biologists deal with all the time. One of the issues we think about when we look at the evolution of a group is, did it happen once or did it happen several times? And for that, we try to use as many independent lines of evidence to reconstruct that story as possible. And again, as I said, fossils, genes, and so forth. There are sometimes, however, when we do this kind of analysis, frequently, that you'll find that a group may have had multiple origins, may have, what we call a single group, may have arisen independently in two or more places. And we call that pattern parallel evolution. And it's actually an interesting thing to research and very important because it's probably very common in different parts of the evolutionary record. And for a simple reason, that is, when we look at different creatures, what we find is the DNA recipe that builds them is often very similar. So what that means is if you're using the same recipe to build bodies, different lineages or different groups that are separated in space may come up with the same independent, strategy. Like if you have one recipe to build a cake, and two people are fiddling with it independently, odds are very good that they might hit on, a similar kind of cake at the end of the day. And so that's the kind of idea. And we call that parallel evolution. And one of the things we try to do, with a lot of computer-based technologies and so forth, is to sort of dissect when do we have the evidence to support parallel evolution, and when do we have the evidence to support single origin.
When you're talking about different cakes, I couldn't help thinking about that old Bob Newhart bit. Remember about the monkeys? I guess because we're talking about evolution, monkeys typing and having the same words come out. You're getting a lot of questions here about Tiktaalik by email. Lee says, if I recall right, Tiktaalik had a lot of digits, just as fish have many rays in their fins, yet from the amphibians, frogs, toads, salamanders, newts, forward, we've all had five digits. If this is historically arbitrary, or is there a reason why we don't have, say, four digits? I can see why not three or ten, but why five?
Yeah, actually, you know, if you look out in the, you know, in the animal world for fingers and toes and so forth, what you'll find is five is just one of a range of conditions out there. So some creatures, like if you look at dinosaurs, they might have two or three or one finger or so forth. So you'll find five seems to be a maximum in some cases. But other creatures actually will have what looks like six or more fingers. Marine reptiles, one group of marine reptiles actually had a flipper made up of lots of fingers. You know, frogs sometimes have a thing which looks like a sixth finger. So we find lots of variability actually in nature. And indeed, we find variability in our own populations. There are humans that have six fingers or seven fingers and so forth. So the genetic capacity to build these things is most definitely there.
And here's Jerry who says, where can we go online to see the creature that you and Neil Shubin are discussing on this morning's program?
Yeah, just Tiktaalik, TikTaalik.uchicago.edu. We have a website on Tiktaalik devoted to the discovery, and it shows pictures of us working in the field, some more in detailed information about the fossil itself, and links to some of the scientific publications where we originally announced the creature.
And I'm going to announce another caller from Battle Creek, Michigan. Autumn, hi.
Hello. I was just wondering, recently we moved birds into the reptile family, and there's been talk that mammals also should belong in that group due to DNA records and things of that nature. We can show back where we kind of branched off of the reptiles. And I was just curious your opinions on that.
Sure. You know, what we commonly call reptiles, it's really a grab bag of a lot of creatures that sort of overall looks similar. Yet, if we look at evolution and we look at the ancestry of creatures, what we find is that dinosaurs, gave rise, which are a kind of a creature we call reptiles, gave rise to birds, or the descendants of dinosaurs gave rise to birds. And the descendants of another kind of creature, which we commonly call reptiles, gave rise to mammals. And that's a beautiful evolutionary series. If you look at rocks, say, about 250 million years old to about 200 million years old, you find one of the most remarkable transformations in the fossil record, the shift from a creature known as a mammal-like reptile, commonly, to mammals. And it's there where you see the gradual evolution of mammalian teeth and the mammalian pattern of chewing, where you see the gradual transformation of a sort of a quasi what we call reptilian jaw to a mammalian jaw and the origin of the mammalian ear. It's just a beautiful series.
Thank you for the call. You are an aesthetic appreciator of all of this. Here's Dave from Berkeley. He says, I was curious about what extent species is most similar to this recently identified transitional form. What model organisms do you use to try to get at what molecular networks might have been present in the fossil species?
Yeah, so we actually can constrain that pretty well now. So in my laboratory, we work on primitive rayfin fish. So we keep in the laboratory the embryos of paddlefish and sturgeon. We have another creature which is very similar to that, which has a fleshy fin called Polypterus. Also, lungfish are a very nice model as well. They're difficult to work in the laboratory, yet we can work with their DNA quite readily. And then we go further down the evolutionary tree to look at sharks and skates. Sharks and cartilaginous fish are actually some of the most primitive living creatures that have appendages. So we look at those in the laboratory. We look at primitive rayfin fish, and we look at living lobefin fish, which are actually closer relatives of Tiktaalik. And so we can sort of triangulate, if you will, by looking at that batch of three kinds of creatures.
You're working with ichthyologists as well?
Yeah, we do. And fortunate, I have a joint appointment at the Field Museum in Chicago where we have some really wonderful ichthyologists.
And more of our wonderful callers. Steve, hi, you're on.
Hey, doctor, speaking of the Field Museum, the last time I was in Chicago and I'm a UFC grad, I saw the great exhibition that they had there of the original items from Gregor Mendel, and was really interesting to see all his equipment and his microscopes from his teapot experiments. When I was fishing down in Florida, our guide caught a garfish and he smacked him against the side of the boat pretty hard. I said, why did he do that? And he said, because they eat up all the other fish and they have not evolved in 2 million years. Is that true? And would you also address the question, does ontology recapitulate phylogeny?
Okay. Phylogeny.
Yeah. Phylogeny. You gave me. I'll answer both, actually. So, you know, gars, you know, a lot of creatures look like they haven't changed for millions and millions and millions of years. And the reality is creatures are mosaics of change. That is, parts of them change slowly, parts of them change fast. So what you look at in a gar, for instance, is if you look at its anatomy, it actually does look pretty primitive. I mean, it actually is, getting back to one of the earlier questions, it could be, it's a good model developmentally for things like Tiktaalik and others. However, that story changes dramatically when you look inside the cells of a gar, when you look inside the DNA. Parts of the DNA of gars are evolving at a very rapid rate. You know, so in a sense, everything on the earth is evolving, yet different parts of bodies evolve at different rates than others, and the gar is a wonderful example of that. Getting back to your second question, which is, you know, does ontogeny recapitulate phylogeny? This is something a lot of us learned in schools, right? This is the
It's old... almost a little anthem or motto that we learned. You might want to break it down for listeners.
Sure, exactly. The idea of ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, it's an old one, is the notion that somehow during developments, like a human, for instance, as it goes from an egg to an adult, will track its evolutionary history, you know, showing a worm stage in development, followed by a fish stage in development, followed by a reptile stage, and so forth. The reality is as we look at embryos and we learn more about them, the story is far more complex. And indeed, it looks like that was an oversimplification of something that's far more complicated. And that is the idea, and what we come back to is the notion that there's a common DNA recipe, or versions of a common DNA recipe that builds different bodies, that they're all variations on a theme, if you will. And what that means is early embryos tend to look more similar to one another than do adults. So the early embryo of a human, a shark, and a turtle, for example, they're not identical, but they have lots of important similarities that are based on that DNA recipe. So if you look at those embryos, they all have gill arches early on. They all form their brain early on in a very similar way, their spinal cord and so forth. And so that is actually a much more powerful way for us to rephrase the ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, and has old roots as well, originally from around the 1830s.
Steve, we thank you for the call. Here's a listener, Graham, who says, do the fish found near volcanic vents in the very deepest parts of the ocean still use gills to extract oxygen from the water?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Sorry.
We go to Roaring Springs, Pennsylvania. Doug, welcome.
Well, yes, thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate it. Dr. Shubin, I was listening to you on Marty Moskowain in Philadelphia about a week ago, and I got your book. It's very interesting reading, by the way. But my first question also is maybe make a comment that we in central Pennsylvania have a rather unique something that, you know, from your book, a unique position there. Maybe
Excellent.
You'll want to comment on that. Number
yeah.
two. You mentioned in your book that fishes, which are, they're basically like an oval shape, obviously the axis is like a north-south, which in your the animals that you found up in the Arctic, the flat heads are basically like an oval that's going east to west. Is there any other animal or anything else that suggests that there's another, something in between there?
Yeah.
And the third question that I have concerns... the rise from what we call, you know, cold-blooded animals to warm-blooded animals, obviously placoderms, to which are nucleated blood cells, to the non-nucleated blood cells. What caused this, and what other kinds of evolutionary stuff? Can you shed some light on that one?
Well, let's start off first with the Pennsylvania connection.
Sure thing. Yeah, that's where it all began for us, for Ted Deschler and myself. Ted is one of the partners, the co-discoverers of Tiktaalik. And Ted and I started working actually in central Pennsylvania around 1993 when I was teaching at the University of Pennsylvania at the time, and Ted began as a graduate student. You know, we were making trips up to the central Pennsylvania, North of State College, quite frequently. And what drew us there was the presence of Devonian age rocks, you know, around a little bit younger than the rocks that ultimately produced Tiktaalik. And those rocks turned out to be wonderfully, and still continue to be, wonderfully productive for fossils. And, you know, along the sides of roads in Pennsylvania, we were picking out just wonderful examples of early amphibians, or tetrapods, limbed animals. We were pulling out large fish and so forth. It was really amazing, you know, this disconnect between present and past. You know, here we are in present-day central Pennsylvania picking at rocks, and inside those rocks is an ancient Amazon delta, you know, with giant fish and so forth. So that was a lot of fun, and we're still continuing that, by the way. We go out every year.
Why am I thinking of John Cleese? Never mind.
Second question, which I forgot. What was the second question?
What was the second?
It concerns your oval.
Oh, the head. Yes, thanks. Yes, thanks.
Yes.
So the second question is actually Tiktaalik has a very flat head. But if you look at creatures lower down the tree, a creature by the name of Pandarichthys and others, they actually have a head that's not quite as flat as Tiktaalik. You know, you go down further, you find, you know, actually find a gradual series in the evolution of flat-headedness in these things. Turns out that there's a couple things going on as you go from a fish that has a conical head with eyes on either side to a creature like Tiktaalik or an early amphibian, which creatures that have a flat head with eyes on top. That kind of flat head with eyes on top, is you see that in lots of different kinds of creatures. Think crocodiles, reptiles, and other kinds of things, which actually will sit on the surface of the water with their eyes sticking out of the water and nostrils out of the water, looking for food. Tiktaalik had a flat head, likely to look out of the water, but also it could live on the bottom of the water and look up at prey. So that kind of thing has evolved multiple times.
By the way, you're listening to Forum, and we have been talking with Neil Shubin, the author of Your Inner Fish, and this is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Doug, you had another question? You're with us on Sirius, I assume. Yeah.
Yes. Going back to reptiles and mammals, reptiles, if memory serves me correctly, have nucleated blood cells, and mammals do not, you know, have non-nucleated blood cells. And also, but just, you know, the question, what was it, if you can speculate, that turned, you know, the quote-unquote cold-blooded animals to warm-blooded animals?
Well, we see all kinds of, you know, what's interesting when you look at nature, nature doesn't easily conform to the simple dichotomies we sometimes describe them, things with. So, like, we describe, like, warm-bloodedness and cold-bloodedness, you know, and we describe them, often when we teach, too, I'm guilty of this as well, is as two distinct categories. But the reality is when you start to look at animals out there and start to look at diversity, what you see is all kinds of different strategies that sort of reveal different ways of doing the same thing and sometimes breaks down these simple dichotomies we use to describe things with. And the same thing is true with like warm-bloodedness and cold-bloodedness. What we call cold-blooded creatures can actually regulate their body temperatures very precisely, you know, through behavioral mechanisms, environmental mechanisms, and so forth. And likewise, what we call warm-blooded animals, their body temperature may vary to some extent. What this comes down to, though, is, you know, how does a warm-blooded animal produce heat? And it usually is, most of it is actually through the metabolic energy and heat released during muscle use, and retaining that in an insulating layer. And it's interesting, though, you find many different creatures kind of hitting on that theme, though. Certain types of billfish in their eye have a heater organ, a form of muscle which will actually keep the eye warm. You know, and so that's a fish that does this. So, well, what I'm saying is that the natural world doesn't easily conform to the simple dichotomies we have, and we find all kinds of strategies to bridge these gaps.
And we thank Doug for the call. Go to another caller on Sirius from Chattanooga. Ben, hi.
Hi. Yeah, it's nice to talk to a fellow fish nerd out there too. When I was first viewing in biology, or not when I was a little kid, I always noticed that all animals have almost identical digestive tracts. I'm wondering if you could talk about that today, and I'll take my comments off air.
All right. We thank you for the call.
Yeah, one of the things that's really fundamental in animals that have backbones, so it's like fish and above, if you will, is that they have a subdivided gut. You know, you have a foregut, a midgut, and a hindgut. And that division is very, very primitive and very basic and likely written by the same genetic recipe. What you start to find, though, as you look in detail at sort of the internal structure of the foregut, hindgut, and midgut, is differences. So, for instance, if you look at the human intestinal tract, we have just, it's really long. And it's folded in on itself a zillion times, particularly the small intestine. And then the large intestine takes this giant loop. Well, if you were to compare our intestine to something like a shark, the shark's intestine is actually kind of straight. It doesn't take all those bizarre loops and turns. And this is another case where our system takes really weird, bizarre loops and turns, but you can straighten it out as you look at more basal, more primitive creatures. You know, so, I mean, while you find the overall subdivisions are present in most creatures, it's actually the internal anatomy of those divisions can actually be very different. And indeed, the tissues that support it, that support them against the body wall, can be very different as well.
Go to Philadelphia. Merrick, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I just wanted to make a reference to one of the earlier comments that your guest had brought up regarding the similarity between embryos. When I was stationed in Germany as a soldier for the U.S. Air Force, I went to the Natural History Museum in Frankfurt, and they have a wonderful exhibit there of all the different embryos of different animals and the similarities. And I just wanted to say, if anyone ever gets the opportunity to see that, they will indeed see how similar the different species are. And in fact, that was a turning point in my own life. It was at that point in time that I began to realize that evolution and that evolution was indeed a reality.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, thank you for the call. Let me try to get one more caller on from Cadillac, Michigan. Rick, hi.
Yes, I wonder if your guest has ever encountered the work of Stephen Wolfram. He provides a pretty interesting mathematical mechanism for evolutionary complexity, which is, I'm sure he's aware, is one of the arguments that the creationists often use against evolution. It's just too complex. And Stephen Wolfram, I've never heard anyone talk about him.
Do you know his work, Neil?
His book is called A New Kind of Science.
Yeah,
we actually were using some of Wolfram's models, these automata that he had back in the 80s, to try to understand development, how cells build bodies. And yeah, it was with mixed results.
I thank the caller, and I thank you, Neil Shubin. Delightful to have you on here. Again, the book is Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 Billion-Year History of the Human Body. And he'll be at Kepler's in Menlo Park at 7:30 this evening. I want to thank our great staff. Dan Zoll is our senior editor, and Kevin Guillory, producer, production assistant Tina Lauerberg, our engineer Danny Bringer, and our executive producer Raul Ramirez. Thank you again for listening and being here. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.